high. They like to run. They like to play. But most of all, they like to eat.
Dad's all torn up and Mom's got like a harpoon stinging in her neck and they're getting bigger.
Critters, they bite. Rated PG-13.
Searching my past for the things that I've seen. Is it my life or just something I dream?
Resume. Noun. 1. A summing up. Summary. 2. A brief written account of personal, educational, and professional qualifications and experience.
Alpha Flight number 36 had a Mike Mignola cover and promised appearances by the Avengers and Doctor Strange. I'm pretty sure my half-brother had a copy. That's all I've got on this one. He definitely had Amazing Spider-Man number 278. With its stark Mike Harris cover of Spidey standing over the body of Flash Thompson dressed as Hobgoblin, the words "Justice is served" written in a shadow cast long across the white background. It looks like peak 80s edge at 10 paces, but you crack that cover and the Vinnie Coletta hits you like a wall of stink. The Tom DeFalco plot over co-scripting duties by Peter David and Joe Duffy raises even more red flags. I'm guessing DeFalco blew his deadline on the development pipeline for Kickers Inc. and needed help pulling together an issue-long Scourge of the Underworld tie-in, where most books just snuck him in for a page or two. In case you didn't know, Mark Gruenwald had the idea to gin up sales on Captain America by giving him a Punisher-like vigilante adversary that specialized in murdering lower-tier Marvel supervillains. Despite the cover tease, it's the Wraith that buys it in this issue. No, not Jim Gordon's son, but Gene DeWolf's brother. Really rough year for that family. My brother was way into Scourge, to the point that he set out to buy every one of those titles in his killing spree. I don't know if he got them all, and I certainly didn't read them all, but Captain America number 319 was among the key issues. After low-key playing out the premise for a few months, this was the issue that announced the Scourge by name on the cover, including the floating heads of a bunch of justifiably worried costume criminals. Along with the Serpent Society, Diamondback had appeared in the title for a few months, but I believe this was the issue that really launched her partnership with Cap through much of Gruenwald's lengthy run. It was obviously intended to give Cap a Catwoman, and inker extraordinaire Joe Sinnott does what he can, but she's just not that appealing in all that pink as drawn by Paul Neary. Apologies to fans of the recently deceased artist, but his work almost single-handedly drove me off the book. Plus, this was the infamous issue with the Massacre at the Bar with No Name, where the Scourge wasted about 17 villains, delivering a substantial portion of the total census of the upcoming revised Handbook of the Dead. If that had happened in a Spider-Man comic, or had Mike Zeck art, we'd still be raving about it today. Instead, it's mostly a footnote, and these guys tended to stay dead. Speaking of Ohatmu, the official handbook of the Marvel Universe Deluxe Edition number 8 was Magus to Mole Man, headlined by Marvel Girl, Mr. Fantastic, and Mockingbird. The art is solid Bronze Age consistency with few real standouts, but Brett Blevins goes out of his way on Man-Thing, and he can't miss a rare Brian Boland appearance on a different Merlin that he's known for. Art Adams' Mojo and Stan Wosch's Modred the Mystic also pop. I think Power Pack number 24 got a house ad plus a cloak appearance, so maybe that's why my brother bought this one. I really like the John Bogdanov art now, but doubt that would have put such a Franklin Richards heavy issue over with me back in the day. Not a lot of TV talk from April of 1986. NBC aired Return to Mayberry, revisiting the cast of The Andy Griffith Show, hot on their recent Matlock success. Don Knotts had a run of movies after his time on the original show, and I recall watching a lot of those flicks with my mama on the Channel 13 Million Dollar Movie on the afternoons after her soaps. Knotts was also Mr. Furley, the nosy apartment manager on Three's Company. We didn't watch Andy Griffith much, though. I always thought it was too genteel and corny. Plus, it was often on either very early in the morning or late in the night when there was better programming up against it. This was also the month where Geraldo Rivera milked 2 hours of television out of opening Al Capone's long-sealed safe, which proved to be empty. That I recall sitting through like a dope. I think my half-brother went back for seconds with Avengers number 269, which was full of Kang lore involving multiple variants, including Immortus. To me, this was awful, convoluted, multiple-Earths DC nonsense. And if the Avengers harbored those sorts of shenanigans, then it was a title to be avoided going forward. I'm definitely familiar with the Tom Mandrake-drawn Two-Face story from Batman number 397, but I'm vague on the timeline. Two-Face was not featured on the 1960s Batman TV show, and had not appeared in animation up to that point. So I didn't know who he was in 1986, much less regard him as a major Batman villain. I recall my introduction, and this wasn't it. This was also from when Batman and Catwoman were basically a duo, leaving Robin to his own devices. When I see Jason Todd on the splash page with a jutted lower lip while dragging an assailant into the police station, I read him as the attitudinal post-crisis incarnation of the New Adventures. Plus, there's a deformed stripper wearing a porcelain mask in this comic that is extremely provocative for the time, but made no impression on me. So I figure this must have been from the 1988 Sacco Comics or later. I'm the one who brought Conan the Barbarian number 184 to the table, probably from out of a three-pack. There are so many covers of that dude fighting giant monsters half-naked, that one where he's mostly clothed, standing semi-hunched in a doorway, stumbling like a zombie, actually stands out in my memory. I wish I could say as much about the story within. It's another Owsley, Buscema, Chan joint, so it looks nice, but much too talky-talky. For some, G.I. Joe, Real American Hero number 41 was probably a shark-jumping moment. The Zek cover features Destro and Dr. Mindbender exiting a pyramid's tomb with a mummy, and the story is titled Serpentor. Yep, the genetically engineered new leader of Cobra, made up of DNA from history's most notorious military leaders and tyrants. Look, I had all three of these action figures, but the bald guy's got a lot more play than the dude with the giant orange snake cowl. Thankfully, we're still a ways out before going full Cobra. The Incredible Hulk number 321 had two teams of Avengers and some Fantastic Four in a throwdown with the Jade Giant, which was more spectacle than little bro could resist. But also, it was like half an issue of Hulkbusters, including a middle-aged Asian woman who judo tosses Hulk, and it's Al Milgram layouts finished by Del Barras. I gave it a toss, but me, I could resist it fine. The Marvel Saga, the official history of the Marvel Universe number 8, reminds me what a weird, thankless gig this was. Peter Sanderson did the research and synopses, but he's only recapping other people's stories without any significant editorializing. The always retro Ron Frenz leans into anonymity with a cover and splash page that looks as much like Steve Ditko and Werner Roth as he could manage. Not exactly what the kids were clamoring for in 1986. Spider-Man goes well out of his comfort zone by hitchhiking on a jet fighter to catch a defective space capsule in mid-descent so that he could deploy its parachute to save the life of astronaut John Jameson. That kid will have no better luck going forward. And by that I mean John Jameson. Peter Parker marries a supermodel. He's just a whiner. There's also coverage of early tales of the Fantastic Four, Thor, Hulk, and Iron Man, which I'm even less interested in now than I was then. There's a distinct lack of retcons allowing the use of art by John Byrne or Bob Layton, so this is a whole lot of rough, loose, exhausted Kirby, punctuated by distinctly jazzier Ditko Spider-Man material involving Chameleon and his failed Fantastic Five bid. Okay, we do get the first thing Hulk bout, and they work in a little Simonson and Sienkiewicz. When you're talking the origin story of Warren Worthington III, fresh takes are very necessary. I guess I was interested enough in Kraven the Hunter and the new Vulture with the green skull cap to buy Marvel Tales starring Spider-Man number 189, but I'm not proud of it. Kraven's lion mane vest shot lasers out of the eye holes. What's that I said about saying no to dumb DC elements in my Marvels? Secret Origins number 4 covered Firestorm, the finer details of which I wasn't aware. I tossed through it at the mall bookstore, but the art and character just didn't appeal to me enough to delve deeper. I guess I didn't want so much Marvel in my DC either. From memory, I would have sworn that Brett Blevins drew the Sword of Solomon Kane number 6 of 6, but the painted cover's by Dan Green and the interiors are John Ridgway. I usually like Al Williamson, but he's a bad fit here, and even worse over Sandy Plunkett in a short poetry section at the end of the book. Kane has never had the drawing power of other Robert E. Howard characters, but something about that bony, severe pilgrim works for me. Oddly enough, he looks like a downward spiral period Trent Reznor here, as he dares to expose his fully nude arms, because he's in Africa, and it's Africa hot, bro. Also, this one has winged demons and severed heads on pikes staring blankly from any panels, and that horror vibe is the lane where Kane most appeals to me. Given that emotionally, John Romita Jr.'s X-Men is my definitive version of the characters, it's funny how readily I avoided issues of his run in comparison to others. Years into my active collecting, I'm perfectly content to continue reading friends and relatives' copies of a supposed favorite title instead of buying my own. I still think that it was mostly down to frugality, but I honestly disliked or was disinterested in a lot of the members, villains, and their designs at this time. I particularly viewed Phoenix 2 unfavorably, with her lousy attitude, trashy mullet, and hideous yellow and red costume. Even when she was in the red vinyl with the spikes, the fetish kink of it was off-putting at that age. Anyway, Uncanny X-Men number 207 was about Rachel Summers putting on a sexy French maid outfit and infiltrating the Hellfire Club in a bid to kill the Black Queen, and somewhere along the way gets stabbed in the gut by Logan. But hey, this was the cover Wolverine slashes with his claws, so I think I got it out of a three-pack a few months later. I barely recall anything that was going on here, so I should probably reread it, but nah.
Think about love.
I was fairly absentee on popular music in this period. We were living in a two-bedroom apartment, so not only weren't my stepsisters living with us anymore, but I doubt there was even many, if any, overnight stays. I don't recall sharing music with my friends in this period, and nobody in my father's family were really into pop. In my room, I went to sleep each night with the clock radio set to a country station. Back then, they cast their net broader, incorporating crossover artists like Elvis Presley, Roy Orbison, and Olivia Newton-John. Also, they reached back further, to at least the mid-60s. I don't recall a lot of 50s country on the radio, so maybe that was shuffled off to AM or something. I was just deleting information in a text document about songs from 1984 through 85 that I didn't get around to using on the show. But it would be more accurate representation of what I was still listening to in 1986 if I just ran them now. Stuff like late 60s Glen Campbell and 70s Kenny Rogers were still in heavy rotation, as I recall. While I was still a kicker in sneakers, I was missing the first run of a lot of swell songs that I'd catch up on later. For instance, while there's a slim chance I heard Howard Jones's No One Is to Blame on first pass, I tend to doubt it. This ode to unrequited longing would resonate strongly with me eventually, but what I heard osmotically trended toward more bubbly fare. I feel like those lyrics are too evocative to have not connected with me if I'd heard them at that time. Simply Red's Holding Back the Years was another good one along those lines, with better odds that I might have caught it contemporaneous to release. It had a long life in adult contemporary, so I'm sure it passed my ears in the workplace or supermarket or whatever. Despite having really dug Tears for Fears' album, Songs from the Big Chair during its run of singles, radio interest seemed to peter out by mid-85 with Head Over Heels, so I didn't hear the remix of Mother's Talk when it came out nearly a year later. I think my father picked up Tears Roll Down, Greatest Hits 82 through 92, and that's when I finally heard it. I liked Madonna from my earliest radio exposure, probably with Lucky Star, back when we all thought that she was a black singer. The video for Borderline cleared that up, which probably made it easier for all those mall tarts to dress up like her after Like a Virgin exploded. Hey, I'm not trying to cast aspersions. My stepsister went through at least one Madonna phase. What would you call a 14-year-old bleach blonde in fishnets and lace opera gloves? Anyway, her third major release, True Blue, seemed to take a little longer to capture an audience. I don't recall hearing its first single, Live to Tell, until I circled back around to pop a few years later. It's one of the Material Girl's darkest, most haunting tracks, and is now a favorite, admittedly among many favorites. I doubt I entirely miss Talking Heads' Once in a Lifetime, but I'm sure like most of you, my thoughts go immediately to the bespectacled David Byrne, drenched in sweat and jerking about in the music video, except I didn't have MTV at the time, and I strongly associate the video from the Martha's Greatest Hits block in the late 80s, early 90s. Also, I was myself fairly recently bespectacled, but I wasn't any different, and nobody who knew me treated me as such. I wasn't an outcast yet, so I didn't gravitate toward oddballs like Byrne. This persona of his would suit me more in the later 80s frame. Speaking of which, friggin' I Wanna Be a Cowboy by Boys Don't Cry. Okay, when we were staying at my mom's best friend's place in Albuquerque, we children of the pair likewise hung out together. This longtime girl space friend of mine warned me that I needed to work on losing my then thick southern accent, as she had hers. I wasn't in a place where I could see the wisdom in conscious assimilation, even though her friends were already picking on me for said accent. I used to have cassette tapes from my early years before my stepfather taped over them, and I wasn't far removed from the twang of the young Sling Blade actor Lucas Black. Anyway, when I ended up living outside Las Vegas for about a year, going to an affluent school, and forced by circumstance to wear cowboy boots, they really let me have it. This one ginger bastard with a face full of freckles was always harassing me in homeroom, not helped by the one time I accidentally farted when bending over to grab my books. A lot of Blazing Saddles jokes at my expense, but the one that really stood out for me was how he'd often sing a few bars of I Want to Be a Cowboy at me, except I'd never heard the damn thing, so it was just a weird little sing-song taunt. Again, I think it was on Martha's Greatest Hits, where I finally gained the full frame of reference. So yeah, that's another traumatic one song each track that I can now skip if we ever get back to doing that show. Related, the last tune I have to touch upon is Tough Enough by the Fabulous Thunderbirds. They were Lone Star Originals, and the song was a huge hit, likely making it onto my country stations, whether KILT or KIKK. But beyond that, the group was listed into the long-lived Don't Mess With Texas anti-litter campaign, adapting their hit for a 30-second PSA that ran for years.
Well, you're riding down the highway in your fancy car, got that radio blasting, and you're feeling like a star. Zooming down the highway, and you've got a heavy load. Don't you trash that Texas highway. Don't you throw it in the road. Don't you mess with Texas. Don't you mess with Texas.
I left the previous issue's cliffhanger hanging for a while, but at some point after release, my half-brother helped me to read the all-new, all-daring Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man number 116 for the Sabretooth appearance. I might need to explain that. At this point, Sabretooth was still best known as an Iron Fist foe that had teamed up with the Hulk villain the Constrictor to more evenly match up with Luke Cage, who had been paired with the martial artist. My friends and I picked up Power Man and Iron Fist on occasion, but I hadn't seen any Sabretooth appearances, and I would have known Constrictor only from a Secret Wars action figure. In about half a year, Sabretooth would join the Marauders in the Mutant Massacre and be positioned as Wolverine's nemesis. Despite already being a hugely popular anti-hero, Logan hadn't really cultivated any prominent foes, the closest by my reckoning being Ogun, who had not survived the Kitty Pryde miniseries. So Sabretooth went from an also-ran and a lower-tier title to an overnight sensation, and little bro liked his characters with mean streaks as wide as Sabretooth's. So even though, of the two of us, I was the relative Spider-Man guy, he's the one who made the purchase sometime later that year or in 87. And it's funny, because it's mostly a Black Cat story, and it establishes a new status quo for Sabretooth that doesn't survive his transition to the X office. Sabretooth is a hired lackey of the Foreigner, who had been introduced a year earlier in Amazing Spider-Man. It was the same issue that debuted Silver Sable, but very discreetly. It had been in a 3-pack that someone had cracked open in a store that I was in, and that I had tossed through. The story was about an elderly thief called the Fox and did not hold my interest. At some point, maybe right from the beginning, the Foreigner was established as Silver Sable's ex-husband, but the character hadn't progressed until Peter David picked him up for use in Spectacular. Peter David tried to make the Foreigner an overarching big bad, but he was just a regular-looking guy without a costume or powers, so it didn't take. Also, Jim Owsley hiring a guy from marketing to replace Al Milgram was not a popular move, so there was immediate pressure to get rid of this guy who would only later become one of Marvel's defining talents. The Foreigner would be used to wrap David's run the following year, out with a whimper. That said, I've long thought it odd that no one ever seemed to do anything with Foreigner's connection to Sabretooth, and being a big-name mercenary, why he was never connected to Deadpool? Maybe because this appearance ended with Sabretooth clawing his own face to get web-fluing off it? And it hurt so bad that Spidey took the pitiful thing to the vet or something. Sabretooth had a lot of emasculating appearances before hitting it big. The penultimate Sectars, number 7, was either a Sack comic or Marauder Books quarterbin buy. Bill Mantlow just wasn't spinning the same gold here as he had on Micronauts, and this story did not stick in my brain. It's a shame, because the art of Steve Geiger and Keith Williams continues to overperform, deserving better. I never read the last issue, and I'm pretty sure the toys were off the shelves, so this is where we bid the Sectors adieu. X-Factor number 6 probably had a circulation of 500,000, and I wasn't much more impressed with Apocalypse than I was the Alliance of Evil. I guess I shouldn't be surprised that high-grade copies go for a few bills, but from my personal experience, it's difficult to assign the book that much value. Walt Simonson insists that he tweaked a Jackson Geiss design, and Geiss only recalls working off a design by Simonson. It sure looks like Simonson to me.
It began in the outer reaches of the universe.
They're coming!
An alien war that spread throughout the galaxies. Now, the final battle has landed in the Brown backyard. Critters.
Once again, movie options for this month are a thin gruel. Band in the Hand was, I think, a VHS rental of my stepfather's. It was about a group of beyond at-risk teens who were recruited for a sort of scared straight program that sees them turn vigilantes against the Miami drug trade. It's at 0% on Rotten Tomatoes. The main thing I remember was a line along the lines of a character getting their rocks off from hurting people. I used that line against my stepfather when he was yelling at my mother over whatever he had a mat on over that particular moment, and he popped me one for it. So that's my Band in the Hand story. Another preferred viewing was Critters, an obvious Gremlins knockoff with the mother from Cujo. It made $13 million on a $3 million budget, so it got three more sequels than Gremlins did, not a single one remotely as good as actual Gremlins, and I'm not even a big fan of that one. It might have been a rental, but it's just as likely I caught it on USA Network or something. Which one had the gag about the Playboy centerfold? That one I saw uncut. If you haven't seen one of these, imagine a gremlin crossed with a Tribble and Sonic the Hedgehog as a puppet on a budget. Add a human-looking alien hunter of the Krites that took his appearance from a music video rocker, and pair with a redneck human deputy that is himself a cross between John Grise and Michael Richards on meth. It's a resoundingly okay film in a consistently meh franchise, but they make really good replicas that I've been tempted to buy at horror conventions until I remember it's just a Krite. Offbeat starred Beverly Hills Cop's Judge Reinhold as a librarian who has to impersonate a police officer buddy while trying to romance a fellow cop played by Meg Tilly. If you can believe it, Harvey Keitel is in this thing, and Roger Ebert gave it 3.5 stars. I know that I saw it because I recognize a bunch of stuff from the trailer, but I have no additional memory. series, and it flopped hard at the box office. Finally, Murphy's Law, which my stepfather rented and I caught later on television. It's kind of like Charles Bronson, The Gauntlet, but that way oversells it. In this version, Kathleen Will Hoyt is the young girl criminal that grizzled cop Bronson has to drag through luckless misadventures. I'll always remember her best from Roadhouse, the real one, but younger folk probably know her as Luke's sister and Jess's mom on Gilmore Girls. Are you as sick as I am of hearing me talk about flipping through issues of Daredevil during the Born Again arc, but never buying them because the storytelling looked too dense? I promise that number 233 is the last time, with the added bonus of my refusing to support an all-timer Captain America guest spot. Next month is an all-fill-in issue, where Mark Gruenwald inflicts Madcap upon us, and Marvel inflicts Klaus Janson upon Steve Ditko. If that doesn't sound like it would work, your hearing's fine. The following month, they tried it with Danny Bolandi, with far more interesting results. It's still anachronistic, like the Kurt Swan, Dave Hunt pairing on Superman, although Bolandi is much more heavy-handed in burying Ditko under his style. But I like Bolandi, so I don't hate it. Then Anna Sinti debuted, and continuing her artist hot streak, was joined for the one issue by freaking Barry Windsor Smith. That was also the month of the Marvel 25th anniversary cover, and a fun headshot with that iconic character-filled border. Lewis Williams then started his Daredevil run without Nascenti, on a fill-in story by someone named John Harkness. Smells fishy to me. Claw was in this one, and I'd had my fill of him during Secret Wars. I mention all this because my anticipation to start buying Daredevil continued to be deferred throughout this time, so I figured to address them in one rip. Another bulk rate bonus entry begins with Meet Misty number 5, wherein I stopped buying a 6-issue miniseries one issue shy, but will finally seal the deal nearly 40 years later. So the first thing I have to investigate is what went wrong with issue 5. The cover featuring Darlene Dunderbeck and Misty Collins at the gym may be an indication. I was never very much for PE. I find Darlene to be a dull adversary, and Misty is oddly sexualized here and throughout the, at least, first story. Look, I'm not a prude, and I don't think women's existences are inherently sexual or anything. I mean that 3 pages of the 7-page opener feature teenage girls in a locker room in states of undress, starting with a splash page featuring an unnamed kid pulling up her dress just below the breast line. Plus, the entire piece is a comedy of errors with Misty and Darlene obsessing over their weight. It precedes a Millie the Model 4-pager about a middle-aged, overweight woman reflecting on her past. So the front-loaded honeypot feels like a bit of overcompensation. That second story was cute at least, with a slight nod to the character's mid-century comics continuity. The last story, Video Wars, goes full Muppet Babies. The girls go to a stand-in for Chuck E. Cheese Pizza, where Darlene challenges Misty to a video game, and she gets lost in a Star Wars pastiche fantasy. Technically, Shirelle and Spike are in this comic, but they have nothing to do in the story but support Misty. The issue is all the things that I didn't like about the series to date, with little of what I had. It gets worse in the finale. I know Meet Misty number 6 was on the stands at the 7-Eleven as usual. I picked it up and tossed through it. Sometimes there's just another comic that you want more, and you leave one behind for a week or so. My strongest memory of that was Kitty Pryde Wolverine number 1, which just didn't quite make it home on the first pass, sold out or got pulled, and I made sure to buy number 2 through 6. This was the exact opposite. I was 5/6 through this thing, felt like I ought to finish, but just didn't want to. It's very possible that it's centering on a wedding hurt it. I'm not married and would rather never be so, but I fully invested in the wedding of Peter Parker to Mary Jane Watson. Looking at the lead story, and it's just Darlene pitted against Misty again. I was so tired of that. As usual, the object of their affections and dispute is soap opera co-star Ricky Martin, who ultimately marries his old flame Lake Lovelock's character in show. However, Ricky doesn't have a line of dialogue in these later issues, although you could argue fair play, given he's just a prop to pit Darlene against Misty throughout the series. Because there have been celebrity designer credits in these comics, I made a point of starting to read those, just like I would have as a kid. There's a very good chance that the Bill Walco, who went on to do Teen Titans comics in an animation style, got his start here. More of a long shot is Rob Schneider of Deuce Bigelow, Male Gigolo Infamy, submitting outfit designs. But I read dozens of these credits between issues, each with multiple fashion montage sequences. Knowing the end was near, I think Trina Robbins wrote her stories around featuring as many of the submissions as possible, and it leads to exceptionally insubstantial material. The final full story is Misty buying a Mary Marvel indebted outfit at the mall, gaining superpowers, but losing them when the colors wash out in the laundry. She tries to replace it, but that shop at the mall supposedly never existed, even though Misty and Shirelle both shopped there. The New Mutants comic is repeatedly and obtrusively referenced, to the point where it feels like Robbins is trying to manifest continued life for her heroine in the Marvel Universe. It isn't even convincingly framed as a fantasy sequence, because multiple characters see and respond to Mall Girl flying around and using super strength, even one from outside the regular cast, who goes home to tell her husband about a thwarted mugging. It feels so odd and desperate. Speaking of, the final single-page gag strip stars Darlene and hinges on a poodle skirt gag. It's 1986. I bought too many Misty issues, not one too few. And the junior Miss Collins never appears again, outside reference material. Millie did, but in appearances that clearly ignored this star comic as outside of Marvel continuity. The last days of the Justice Society special number one was another one from my buddy's Grocery Sacco Comics in the summer of 88, though I did eventually buy my own copy a decade or so down the line. Part of the reason Roy Thomas left Marvel for DC was to get the chance to write the Golden Age heroes he'd grown up with, and DC made him bury them. As a consequence of Crisis on Infinite Earths, DC wanted all the old-timers off the board. A few of them had already been killed off in the event, so the book starts at their funeral. Then the Spectre showed up to explain that he and the universe itself were dying. As he'd come from a near-future resolution of World War II where the JSA were all gunned down by Nazis. So the team does a redo, and this time they're all killed by Norse gods summoned by the Spear of Destiny. I realized Hitner had a fascination with the supernatural, and used the Norse as a way to provide a Teutonic mythology for his regime. What I don't get is what the spear that pierced the side of Christ on the cross has to do with Asgard. And this wasn't even Thomas's doing, but I also thought it was dopey that the power of the Spear of Destiny was what prevented the JSA from invading Germany to end the war sooner. I guess this special helps to illustrate the point, but it has the unfortunate side effect of demonstrating Adolf Hitler besting America's superheroes twice over and seemingly unto infinity. You see, the whole premise hinges on the Twilight of the Gods, the Norse myth of the end times. In fact, I was introduced to the concept of Ragnarok by this comic. Anyway, rather than bringing the Norse apocalypse, the JSA are able to cause Ragnarok to perpetually reset, rather than progress to engulfing the Earth and even all of existence. It was a real downer ending. And the combination of Dave Ross and Mike Gustavich brought an old-timey newspaper strip verisimilitude that signaled the death of my interest in reading this comic or any other with the JSA for years to come. I had picked up All-Star Squadron in the Jerry Ordway days, but that book was toast. It was replaced by Young All-Stars, which also looked like a Classics Illustrated, and featured lame analogs for DC Icons in the overpriced direct market format. I don't think I ever had a chance to read those new, and having read some since, was better off that way. I'd eventually start to come around on the Golden Age Superman stand-in, Iron Monroe, in the pages of Damage, and James Robinson would turn me around on the JSA in Starman. But for now, good riddance. And before long, Roy Thomas would be back at Marvel, producing comics about their Golden Age that I also wanted nothing to do with. Say it with me, not much of historical value to tell this month. Clint Eastwood was elected mayor of Carmel, California, and as my stepfather's favorite actor, that was somewhat notable. I never heard much about how he actually governed, but it's a town of barely over 3,000. Even I can handle that. Halley's Comet was the closest it's ever likely to get to Earth in my lifetime. I couldn't see it with the naked eye, and that's all I had to work with. Not very good ones at that. More than the comet, I remember all the talk of historical foreboding around its cycle of returns. Comets were on people's brains for a few years, and we got at least one cold classic out of that. Finally, a digital hijacker calling himself Captain Midnight briefly hacked the signal for home box office in order to protest a rate hike to $12.95 a month. For the record, that would be $37 a day, but you can stream max for between $10 and $20 a month now. But what the guy was really mad about was that HBO scrambling its signal had tanked his satellite dish business after he dropped out of engineering school, because of course it was a prep school silver spoon with the means and contacts to pull this off, and his great protest was over cable pricing. Little Bro bought Alpha Flight number 37, where Dave Ross was slightly better served by Jerry Teliok than he had been Mike Gustavich, but only because it dated his look back to the 70s instead of the 50s. Heck, both stories even featured extended flashbacks to the olden days. This one's set in 1848. It's about some zombie sailor dude covering Canada's heroes in worms and other pestilence. I like the weird horror angle now, but it wasn't really what the target demographic of a fading X-Men spinoff was probably after. Amazing Spider-Man number 279 was another half-brother half-comic, so maybe he was the Spider-Man guy after all? This was another chapter of Missing in Action, which tried to make a crossover event out of having supporting cast members carrying books. So this one offers Silver Sable versus Jack-O-Lantern in a battle of lowered expectations. To highlight this, it was drawn by a personal non-favorite Rick Leonardi, and to really lean in, as inked by Vinnie Coletta. If you can believe it, Leonardi's style is so outsized that it mostly thwarts Coletta's attempts to muck it up. Plus, it's simple enough that he doesn't have any excuse to just erase any pencils he didn't get around to before quitting time. I have to admit, Leonardi was a good match for Silver Sable and Tom DeFalco's script, causing me to overestimate her appeal for a few years. Captain America number 320 also shipped this month, the explosive climax to the Year of the Scourge. I'd have to do more research than I'm willing to verify that assertion. But I don't think Scourge got half a year, did he? For some reason, I remember this issue more than the previous. maybe because it featured Water Wizard, who I knew from one of my earlier comics purchases, an issue of Ghost Rider. He's the one who led Cap to the bar with no name, filled with the rotting corpses of Scourge's victims. This was also the first time we saw Scourge in his skull mask. To catch a killer, Cap planted a news item that Mirage had survived the massacre, going so far as to wear the dead man's costume to bait Scourge. I think the morbidity stuck with me more than the sensationalism. Taking a page from Steve Ditko's desire to reveal Green Goblin as just some guy with no personal connection to Spider-Man, the Scourge was a nobody killed by another Scourge after he was captured. I like that, but I have to concede that Stan Lee's directive for Norman Osborn to be Green Goblin had a tad more lasting impact on comic book storytelling. Thanks to the same shipping week overhang, we also got another old hot moo in April. Molecule Man to Owl in Official Handbook of the Marvel Universe Deluxe Edition number 9 is in my wheelhouse with Moon Knight, Nomad, and Nightcrawler on another swell John Byrne cover. I'm sure glad he made it for most of his first year without any glaring replacements, unlike Who's Who. This issue has ebbs and flows, starting strong, withering, Second Wind, Winded. My usual favorites like Sandy Plunkett, Alan Weiss, Rudy Nebris, and Mike Zeck glow up lesser lights like a non-vampiric Michael Morbius in Nightshade. Earlier this year, I was still tweaking the evolving format for this show. I decided to more thoroughly cover contemporary television, music, movies, and historical events on 4-week months. I wish there was a newsstand overview site for books and magazines, the way the late Mike set up his Amazing World of Comics, but I have not found any such resource. It's not that you can't find the release or cover dates for non-comics periodicals and novels, but you have to research each individual title on its own. One hack that I found is that if you go to mycomicshop.com, the online version of my fellow Texans Lone Star Comics, you can view items available organized by month. It's still mostly comic books and related periodicals, but it can help you stumble upon unexpected finds or trigger memories of other releases that I associate with what they offer. For instance, I belatedly covered the 1985 Modern Voltron comics, which did not have release dates, so it wasn't caught in either Mike's or Lone Star's databases, but ads in other comics for the Voltron figures reminded me of Voltron books, which then recalled that one guy I knew had the full die-cast Matchbox Lion Force Voltron, and who in some way was involved in my getting a James Howe book. Whether it was a gift or a trade, that kid was somehow related to my reading Holiday Inn, my favorite book in that time, and going on to other books as referenced in the January episode. Whatever helps me find my way to a rabbit hole to jump down. Since I also brought up a Choose Your Own Adventure knockoff series that I read last time, I figured I should talk about the real deal. I'm not sure when exactly I started reading the series, surely in grade school. One of my relatives was briefly institutionalized for suicidal ideation, and I remember taking at least one of the books on our visits. Then as now, I loved comic books above all other things, but as a fairly prolific novel reader as well. The stories in Choose Your Own Adventure were nothing to treasure, but at a time when the height of solo interactive storytelling was the Oregon Trail on PC, the books were remarkably engaging and vastly more portable. Instead of having to read an on-the-rails narrative from cover to cover, you'd read a brief setup prologue in the second person, then you as some form of expert or adventurer would be given a choice in the direction of the story. Turn left or right, light a torch or feel your way in the dark, talk to this person or brain them with a wooden plank. The decision would mean turning to a designated page in the book where you would read the result of your choice, up to and including your EC comic style ghoulish demise. Obviously a veteran reader would keep a finger placed on the page of the crisis point so you could respawn and continue on from the second, better choice after making a mistake. They were brisk, fun, and fraught with peril. I think most were less than a couple of hundred pages, of which you might read half until reaching a satisfying stopping point, plus no dang leveling grind as I'd experienced with video games like Legend of Zelda and Final Fantasy. Because the novels were relatively disposable, I never bought them, only checked them out at the library. They are also difficult to distinguish in retrospect. My best guess for reads include The Cave of Time, Journey Under the Sea, The Third Planet from Altair, The Abominable Snowman, Vampire Express, and Spy for George Washington. The only one that really stands out as an almost definite read was book number 37, War with the Evil Power Master, which is super distinctive. I do think I tried most every sci-fi and horror one I could get my hands on, but I was less likely to be into anything historical or involving native cultures. You know, the more I think about it, You Are a Shark seems dumb in a way I find familiar. Anyway, as the decade wore on and video games improved by leaps and bounds, the novelty of Choose Your Own Adventure started to wear off. Partly I was probably aging out of the demographic target for the quality of writing, and there were similar books skewing older with additional twists to game the interaction. For instance, Twist of Plot had much better airbrushed covers, and several were written by R.L. Stine. I'm pretty sure I read at least one of the Indiana Jones Find Your Fate series, which traded on my affection for the cultural icon archaeologist. I want to say I tried at least one of the TSR Dungeons & Dragons Endless Quest books, but I think I disliked the subject matter, extra length, and being forced to adopt a prefab character. Anyway, we'll stumble upon more of these as we go along with this podcast. There'll be sad songs to make
make you cry. Love songs often do. They can touch the heart of someone new. Saying I love you.
Among those wanting to see our resume were Bob at Megathumbzilla, Bruce Leap, Chris at Bad Books for Beginners, Chris Dunford, Chris Leiden, Conventure Comics, Dave's Comic Heroes Blog, Derek W.C., Ed Moore at Teal Productions, G.I. Joeberg, Gregory Litchfield, History of Comics on Film, I Was Joe Was, The Irredeemable Shag, JMT Productions, Julia Raoul, Kailash Jwalamukhi, Writer and Media in Charge, Keith G. Baker, Lucretia Garcia, M.M. Beats, Maxo, Mev, Moody Machan, Once Upon a Geek, Petrus Gaspard, Pop Culture Affidavit, who noted, "This was my first G.I. Joe comic. It was in a favor bag at my friend's birthday party. Satin Tights, a Wonder Woman podcast, Siskoid, Skinny at Easy Action 69, Speaker of the House Kirk Spencer, Superbound, Thirsty's New and Used, and Tim Wilsey."
Searching my mind for some truth to reveal. What thoughts are fantasy, what memory?